Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about filmmaker Agnes Varda. And Mike, why don't you start us off about Agnes Varda?
Well, let's put it in context here. Most of our audience will be familiar with the French New Wave. We think of François Truffaut with The 400 Blows in 1959. We think about Jean-Luc Godard with Breathless in 1960. And the attributes there, that these were filmmakers who in most cases had been working as film critics initially for Cahiers du Cinéma, a very influential film magazine then and to this day, actually. And they came in that way. They really thought of film in terms of what they would call the auteur theory, that the director is the author of a film, just as he or she might be for a novel or a play or what have you. We tend to think of that as a really getting going in the late 50s. When you look more closely, of course, you realize that some of the directors involved in that movement, and I hasten to add, these are individuals who've been lumped together in a movement. They've got very distinctive identities as directors in terms of concerns and this and that, but they also do have friendships and some collaborations early on, at least, and so on. When you start to look at some of the individual members, you know, Truffaut himself, but then people like Louis Malle and Alain René and so on, many of them actually started making films somewhat earlier, and so it gets a little squishy and academic as to when you say the New Wave started. But they were against what Truffaut referred to as just sort of the boring, the safe quality of what he called, speaking of quality, quality film. Who could be opposed to quality? Well, he was. He was opposed to quality in the sense that, you know, when people talk about, you know, the quality cinema, what they meant in France in the 50s was a French imitation of Hollywood. Very artificial stories, you know, a lot of production value and this and that, but a kind of artifice, a kind of studio claustrophobia, if you will, a kind of fakery. And what they wanted to do was get film out of that kind of studio setting and literally shoot in the street, shoot in actual apartments, rather than cumbersome cameras, use the newly available lightweight cameras you could put on the shoulder or put in the wheelchair and push around, whatever, to get out into the street, to get out into real life. So it's like, in effect, opening the window and letting in fresh air. Godard like to say that, you know, if somebody's in an apartment, open the window and have real traffic noise out there, not something that the Foley artist is doing back in the studio. So within that context, you'll notice from what I've said, I'm mainly talking about male directors. And so for better, for worse, certainly in a generational way, the French New Wave was considered, you know, the guys, you know, I mean, you know, there's no way around that. You know, it's pretty much, you know, some really strong-willed, really soon-to-be-famous French film directors who are almost all male. And, you know, Varda is something of, she's in the movement and she's not quite in the movement. This is something Marie and I will be talking about, but she's there. And she's there actually earlier than some of the guys were. You know, she was born in 1928. Good, solid educational background. She studied at the Sorbonne. She also studied at the École du Louvre. So, and she began her career really as a still photographer, including for the theater, not just for film sets, whatever. And if you watch her later films, even though they're open and kind of improvisational in various ways, she always had what I call an eye. She has some really striking compositions, even in works that weren't very carefully planned. You know, when you have an eye, it's like a photographer. You hit the street and you see something that lines up, and the compositional balance is there. It wasn't storyboarded like Hitchcock would do it, but you know what? You see it and you snap it, and she always had that. Now, when she made her first film, La Poire Court, in 1954, interesting to note that that film was edited by Alain René, you know, later become famous for films like, you know, last year at Marienbad, and so on, Hiroshima Mon Amour. And so she's already collaborating with some of the people who would be, you know, more or less in the French New Wave. And they're becoming famous before she becomes famous. And I got to say right now, she's always been well known and appreciated by cineasts. I should be able to use that French word in our discussion of Varda's career. But she's never had like the, you know, top of the marquee kind of recognition that the male counterparts would have in France and certainly in the United States, where people who really are film buffs would know her. The general public would more immediately recognize, you know, Claude Chabrol or Eric Rohmer even, or certainly, you know, Truffaut, Godard, and so on. I mean, and those are all art house names, but even on the art house circuit, those guys, and they are guys, would be better known than she would be. And maybe, Marie, you want to pick up at this point, because it's interesting that she's, like, both in the movement and really not in the movement.
Yeah, I think where she is, you know, just as valid as the guys, is that the whole Nouvelle Vague, the whole New Wave, was all about trying new things, and especially trying things that, you know, were counterintuitive. And when you mentioned the movie La Pointe Courte, she said about that movie that it showed how an outsider could make a movie. And what I find really beautiful about that film is because she is a photographer, every scene is framed so beautifully. You could almost take any group of stills from that movie and make a coffee table book of beautiful photography. She really does have a fabulous eye. And one of the things that she did that I thought was really very, very creative was when she was mulling over how to represent, the lives of women and how women feel about their bodies. She decided to physically tether herself with a cord and that just go out as far as it would let her, like it was an umbilical cord, to sort of represent that trappedness and how much could you do with that. And as far as that would let her go with her camera, she would take images of what was going on in her neighborhood. So when you figure out what a great documentarian she is, it's because of that. It's because she thinks about things in those terms, like, what can I do that hasn't been done? What would be representative? And how can I make it look interesting?
And even in the films of hers that are most open, and by open I mean, maybe loosely scripted or literally road pictures, the fact that, sometimes there you don't think about framing, you just think about, capturing whatever's happening around you. But because she's a photographer initially, and I would say primarily, you don't lose that eye. And that's what Marie was saying, that, even in the later and somewhat looser, and I don't mean loose in a pejorative way, but somewhat more loosely constructed narratives, there will be images that you're absolutely right. You could, like, take that still image and, hang it on the wall. She always retained that ability. The second thing Marie mentioned I want to pick up on briefly, and we'll talk about this at greater length as we go along, is the fact that Varda has made a number of documentaries throughout her career. She's also made a more limited number of feature films, but my immediate point is that she's made a number of films that I would call hybrids. Some of her feature films are pseudo documentaries and have that quality. Some of her documentaries work in some, whether it's imagery or through the editing or what have you, where you'd say, well, this is not a standard documentary. And it gets you into creatively fertile territory because she's blurring some of the traditional or, let's say, stereotypical assumptions one has about, well, this is appropriate for a feature film and that's appropriate for a documentary. Much of her best work actually has a bit of blurring there.
Are there any of her documentaries that you particularly like that you would suggest that our listeners would check out?
Well, yeah, I'll jump to it. Well, I was going to mention this later, but let me mention it now. To the very end of her career, some of her very best films really come late in her career, and actually, in terms of the extent to which she had public recognition, and I mean widespread here. I mean, cineasts always knew her. The broader public, I'll go to the very end of her career, almost the end. I mean, she dies in 2019. In 2017, she makes a documentary film called Faces, Places. And she's well into her 80s at that point, and she goes out with a guy who's a friend of hers, actually, the photographer who goes by the initials J.R. And he's a photographer, he's also a muralist, he does wall art. And they go around the French countryside, very much just like, two pals in a car driving around. They stop wherever they want to stop. They're just hanging out. They talk to people, almost like what Marie mentioned before, just like, you're out there on the street and just like talking to people. And it's a very personalized film that way because, he asks her about her career. She talks about things. There's some inserts and places where you can work in some background information. But a lot of it's just like essentially a road picture, in this case, essentially a documentary film. And what I'll mention is I think it's a really good film because it's so late in her career. She really is thinking back on things as much as thinking forward. And so, surveying the whole career. But also notable there, 2017, the film receives an Academy Award nomination for Best Documentary. And in that same year, at that year's Academy Award, so think of it this way. Here she is, she's got an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary. She's there at the Academy Award ceremony. I wish they hadn't put her at the back of the room, but she's there. And that same year, 2017, at the same Academy Award ceremony, she is given an honorary Academy Award for Lifetime Achievement. So that's the case where even though she's been somewhat under the radar for at least general moviegoers, people do notice her. They're aware of her, not just cineasts, but within Hollywood, any number of people working in the mainstream industry, they know her. They know of her and respect her. And emotionally, that meant a lot to me that at the end of her life, she had that kind of imprimatur that Hollywood officially was saying, we'll give you an Oscar nomination. We also give you an honorary Academy Award. And she was very gracious about it. Was always a very forthright, very, very articulate film director, in terms of who she is and what she's about. And to me, that was really like almost overwhelming that, here at the end of her life, people saying, yes, we know what you've done. We honor and respect that very long career.
She is quoted as saying, "Hollywood cinema remains profoundly conservative, profoundly stupid, and often painful." And then she goes on to talk about herself as an artist filmmaker to say, "I am trying to recover the term artist and artisan for those who, in the seventh art, don't exactly make major motion pictures, but films, films that are also part of cinema. I make films, not deals." And that makes it obvious that some of her stuff is going to be a little outside the mainstream. But one movie that I think is very much in the mainstream and very watchable is 1962's Cleo from 5 to 7, which, by the way, was remade as a Sarah Jessica Parker movie, Here and Now, which I do not recommend anybody go see. Cleo
I second that.
is quite an interesting look at a woman who everyone is looking at, and she gets to the point where she doesn't want to be looked at. She wants to be the one who looks. There's one of the themes going on in that movie. What do you want to say about Cleo, Mike?
Well, the story itself concerns a pop singer who's awaiting a medical exam. So again, that career-long interest she's had in the lives of women specifically. And this is where, for me, it's what I call a plus-minus equation. By that I mean in terms of sort of mixed signals there. It's one of the films that comes along at the very point where those French film directors, the guys, are really running, all out. You've got Godard and Truffaut and Romer and Chabrol and René. They're all making some of their most famous films, and they are breaking through as an American film distribution and recognition, that auteur theory in operation there. It's really at the peak of that. And when she releases Cleo from 5 to 7 in 1962, it is released as and considered as part of that overall Nouvelle Vague. It's part of that French New Wave. And so that's all a plus. I mean, it's a really good film, and it gets her recognition and so on. The minus is this, and Varda would talk about this and would justify bitterness in later years, that when the guys were making their films, they would go from one major film project to the next. And her bitterness was that she released Cleo from 5 to 7, well received. I mean, it was not as, in terms of subject matter and style, it's not as cutting edge, it's not as bold, it's not as esoteric as some of the other work might strike, conventional, not just audiences, but distributors, exhibitors. And so it's the sort of film that should have led to a lot of other feature films, right? Her bitterness was the fact that for some reason it was easier for the guys to raise money for the next film project than it was for her. And this goes throughout her career, that one reason why she made so many little documentaries and pseudo-documentaries and could go years between feature films, frankly, was she had trouble raising money. So that's where she thought gender directly factored into it. Why is it that the guys are getting these financial opportunities and she is not? Is it that they're better directors or better connected or what? I mean, you can speculate endlessly there, but gender does seem to factor into it. Now, having just said that, let me partly contradict myself in the sense that, it can be tough for anyone to raise money to make movies. She was famously married to Jacques Demy, the French director best known for The Umbrellas of Cherbourg and The Young Girls of Rochefort. Very long and loving marriage. After he died, she would actually end up making three documentary films about him. I mean, really quite tender to see all those films and to think about that long-lasting professional marriage. Demy himself, even though he had, great recognition in France and in the United States, was making films, but he had frustrations that way too. Indeed, when you talked about her bitterness towards Hollywood before, she's married to Demy for 32 years. She's making her films, he's making his, but even he's not exactly blessed by American financial sources. They do go to Hollywood in the late 60s. I mean, the invitation is extended there. And, while they're in Hollywood, he's able to make, one feature film, but he mostly strikes out. So that's the point I want to make. In the late 60s, 68 specifically, he struggles to get a single film made in Hollywood, and it doesn't turn out well for anybody. So it's not a happy story for him. But, and she also tries to get movies made in Hollywood. She makes a film called Lion's Love in 1969, a ménage à trois story. Hey, these are French filmmakers. But it's set in Hollywood, and Viva, best known for her work with Andy Warhol, stars in it. So very much, finger on the pulse of things. It's a, marginal film commercially, but she only gets that one made. She makes a few documentaries, including, and Maria, you'll appreciate this, one of her little documentaries made, when I say little, I mean running time-wise, one of her documentaries made in Hollywood is about the Black Panthers. And since you and I have been talking about Jean Seberg and various other connections, Jane Fonda and all that, somehow the Black Panthers keep popping up here. She also formed a friendship with Jim Morrison. So she's very much tapped into American pop culture at that time, but she's not able to get anything meaningful, and when I say meaningful, I mean like long-term business-wise going in Hollywood. But it's got to be said, you could say, well, as a woman trying to make it in Hollywood, much less a French woman, at the edge of the French New Wave, but it's not just that, because even her husband Jacques Demy can't quite make it in Hollywood. You know, he's enough out of that mainstream, and it's because they are essentially, you know, individual filmmakers with strong visions and what they want to do, and they don't fit into a nice, neat category or box, if you will, in terms of what Hollywood wants from its directors.
He did put himself on the map a little bit with Catherine Deneuve in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
That's why I mentioned, I did mention Umbrellas of Cherbourg and Young Girls of Rochefort. I mean, those films were widely distributed in the United States, so he absolutely did have some recognition here, but that recognition wasn't enough to get him successfully launched in Hollywood.
No, not in Hollywood. You're right about that. But, you know, I think Agnès Varda said something about the Umbrellas movie. It's, no one is hurt by the fact that it stars Catherine Deneuve when she's 20.
How can you go wrong? You know what I'm
saying? How can you go wrong?
I mean, one of the most beautiful actresses ever, I mean, you know, through the decades, but particularly at that point in her career, just stunning visually. I mean, all you need to do is get a close-up shot, and how can you go wrong aesthetically? Just hold that shot.
So I wanted to talk about 1985's Vagabond.
Yes.
I think it's such an incredible movie, and it's such an interesting movie in that it gives you a character who is completely unsympathetic. And when I've taught French film and shown this, you know, it does not really, it makes people very uncomfortable because it's about a woman who decides she's just not going to participate in the world. She's going to live outside and keep moving and just let what happens happens. And it's very frustrating for the viewer to watch because you keep thinking so many things that happen to the character could be prevented by just not being so willful. But it's very interesting. The character's name is Mona. And one of the questions that comes up when you're watching it is Mona dirty because she's free or free because she's dirty? So the whole time you're watching it, the things that make you uncomfortable about the character and the storyline are things that sort of fold in on itself. Like, well, what is it exactly that is bothering you? Is it the portrayal of a woman doing something women don't do? Or is it that she is just so bedraggled by the end and you can't save her?
Well, let me pick up on that and amplify it in the sense of we talked about Varda in terms of career-long interest in the lives of women. When we look at Varda's career, she's really known for making films that focus on women, whether documentaries, feature films, or hybrid films, if you will. You know, Cleo from 5 to 7, for instance. And the film I'll mention quickly before talking about Vagabond, as we have been, is in 1977, she made a film called One Sings, the Other Doesn't, which is about a friendship of women over a 15-year period. And there, the women, and again, the range of humanity of women as well, of course, the fact that there, it's a very kind of assertive and affirmative, kind of cheerful presentation of women and of the friendships between them. And in fact, Pauline Kael, in her review in the New Yorker magazine, put it this way, quote, "It's a cheery, educational, feminism can be fun movie," close quote. So again, as feminism is becoming a strong movement, she's presenting that in a very affirmative way. But the same director, Varda, having made that film in 1977 and 1985, makes Vagabond. Yes, there's a female protagonist, but a very different one. Not all women are alike, of course, in the range of humanity, whether male or female. And Vagabond is what I call a pseudo-documentary about a wanderer played by Sandrine Bonnaire. She is very much an ornery character. She's not particularly likable. And I think the reason that many audiences were alienated, in fact, the film had some savage reviews, is twofold. One is the fact that, yes, the protagonist is not very nice, and you're spending the whole movie with her as she wanders around. And number two, the film is picaresque. It has an episodic quality. It kind of floats along place to place, and audiences, you know, oftentimes want a more conventional narrative in terms of rising action and climax and all that. And this is more observational. So let me get two quotations from Varda herself, directly to this. One has to do with her screenplays. Yes, she does write all of her own screenplays, but oftentimes in a way that, even if they're not sketchy, they at least allow for, when I say improvisation, I mean, you know, you're on location, you're on the road, you make changes as things happen, you respond that way. And here's the quote from Varda, quote, "People speak about solid screenplays. What about liquid screenplays? The shooting depends on what I feel. It's a live experience," close quote. And the second quote from Varda I'll give is specifically about Vagabond, the film that Marie was mentioning, because, you know, Varda was well aware of the criticisms made of the film, and, you know, when I mentioned those, the, you know, the underpinning for criticism like that is, well, you know, what's this film really about? What do we know about the character? You know, shouldn't we like her more? Shouldn't she be nicer? Shouldn't we have a better psychological understanding of why she does some of the bad stuff she does? And this is what Varda said. Now, this is, again, she's talking to a journalist who's asking her about Vagabond, and she puts it this way, quote, "Social behavior and environment are more important sometimes than psychology. I'm not there to judge. I am not at all a moralist," close quote. So again, people are looking for like conventional explanations or, you know, somehow trying to understand behavior. She's saying, in effect, you know, if you're making this kind of pseudo-documentary, which it essentially is, you're following a person. And people can be mysterious and ambiguous and not always very nice and all. And she's not going to set up a story for you in which you have, you know, a forced happy ending or even a forced understanding of who this character is.
That's very true. And another thing I'd like to mention about this movie is, you know, really, it's a grand metaphor for the fact that we're all passing through, aren't we? And one of the things that makes the movie interesting to watch is that sense you get of what it's like to really be out there alone and all the anxieties you have of all the terrible things that can happen. And Varda said that the sound engineer who had worked on Paris, Texas, which is another nomadic film, did really good work for Varda because she'd asked him things like not only getting the sound of Mona's footsteps, but even the noise of her jeans rubbing, because these are the noises you hear when you're alone, the sound of a zipper getting stuck, the particular resonance of a rock hitting a tent spike, different sounds according to the texture of the fields. And she wanted to hear all of that because that's what helps the audience be with Mona, live with her. You need really skilled technicians to produce films like that so that they don't seem fabricated and ring true. So even the sound is very well done in this movie. Very highly recommend watching it, but I will warn it as a, it's an unsettling movie.
Yeah, I would not make it the first film of hers. I would, you know, I mean, as we're recommending films to watch, there are a few others that are more viewer-friendly, and I don't mean that in a condescending way whatsoever, just simply like if you want an entree to the kinds of films she makes, certainly Vagabond is, you know, a supreme example, but honestly, maybe not the best example by way of, like for you know, starting out, what's the first film I should watch by her? If you make Vagabond the first film, it's probably also going to be the last film by far you ever want to watch. You know, it's a tough case. I would think some of the other films, like, you know, One Thing, The Other Dozen, or Clear from 5 to 7, or Faces Places. Although even there, you know, if you watch films from late in her career, you have to realize that she's commenting on earlier films and all that you might not have seen at that point. And in fact, as far back as 1991, you know, Vincent Canby had said that about her from Canby's New York Times article. He said, "She lives in a present that is ever enriched by the accumulating past." And so if you do watch films like the documentary she made about her late husband, Jacques Demy, or her own films made late in life like Faces Places, you realize that, you know, she is, you know, moving around the countryside, talking to people the present day, but constantly also ruminating, thinking back on her own personal life, her own filmography, if you will. So in terms of, you know, where one would start with her, if you're bold and really bold, yeah, why not? Go all out and hit it right on with Vagabond. But otherwise, there might be two or three of the other films that are a little easier viewing. Let's put it that way. And then if you're kind of hooked on them and you get interested, yes, absolutely, you want to see Vagabond.
I would also mention that she made a couple of movies with Jane Birkin, whose name always seems to keep popping back up. She was a model back in the day and, of course, married Serge Gainsbourg and had Charlotte, who's a very famous French actress, also in some of the movies with Agnès Varda, with their mom, Jane Birkin. And I bring that up because I've been watching a TV show called The Good Fight, and they brought up a little side issue about a Birkin bag. So there's a very famous handbag out there that was named for and created for Jane Birkin. And it's still famous. It's still hard to get. It's still expensive. And she is still popping up as a character in Agnès Varda movies.
That's an important part of the filmography, both for Burke and for Varda, though I've got to say quite honestly, quite bluntly, that their work together is not really their best work. I mean, for instance, in 1988, Jane Birkin appeared in Varda's film Kung Fu Master, which is not a particularly good film, but indicative of that they did have a close, not just working relationship, I mean, they really were close. And so these are overlapping careers. And even though they've both done better work elsewhere, the fact that they did work together, you're absolutely right.
And that film, by the way, also stars her son, Mathieu Demy.
Yeah, sorry, that's her son. Yeah, that's right. That's the actor's son that she had with Jacques Demy. So if you're a film buff, particularly a French film buff, you'll be familiar with some of the Demy films like Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and you'll be inclined then to want to watch the documentary films that she made, like Jacques de Nantes in 1991, films she made about her husband, because, my goodness, these are overlapping film careers. I mean, here's Varda in the context of our conversation, but then when she makes these documentaries about Jacques Demy, it just takes you into so many other aspects of French filmmaking. And Marie, you're absolutely right. I mean, that broader discussion does get into, mentioning Jane Birkin and any number of people. It's really like, being in the right film industry at the right time. You know what I'm getting at? It's relatively small, and you sort of know everybody and work together. And just as a very quick footnote to that, in Cleo from 5 to 7, which is helping to put Agnès Varda on the map for French New Wave audiences, Jean-Luc Godard appears in that film as a silent clown. I mean, there are some direct overlaps here where one director is popping up in another director's work.
So truly, it is a lot of faces, places.
In fact, that's why in Faces, Places, I mean, you see faces in wall murals, and J.R. is also a muralist. You see faces there, but then you have live people, villagers, standing in front of the mural. So you have the faces in a mural, and then you have, real live villagers there talking to them just casually about, what's life like here, what's the bread like, stuff like that. And then traveling around France, just, sampling French life. I mean, it's a very loose-flowing kind of film that way, which is actually one of the great virtues of the film, is it doesn't have a strictly mandated screen. It kind of wanders around, but wanders to interesting places and faces.
Well, that brings us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check us out online at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com, and we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.